That's why I name my pets things like temporary.
Temporary?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
Jesse Dunn was against our ways. He knew it, I know it. I ain't raised no stink at all about whatever became of him. But she ain't my brother. He's about all the close family I got left, so I'll be collecting her now. Carrying her on out of here to home.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 173 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, here's a doobie for your walk.
Yeah. And we are also joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, gotta hand it to this movie, Arenos.
Yeah, this movie, as has been referenced by Jeremy and Aaron, is going to be Winter's Bone today. Be interesting to talk about this one. We also like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We appreciate you coming out and watching us today. Let's start off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Aaron, let's go.
Yeah, let's talk about Eddington, shall we?
Must we?
I loved this movie. Now, is Ari or Ari? I think it's Ari.
I think it's Ari.
That's what I usually say. Ari Aster has been a really interesting journey for me. Hereditary was just completely missed me. Didn't enjoy it. Not my kind of movie. One of those kind of things where it just didn't work for me. And then following it up with Midsommar, which I loved because I loved a lot of the things it was doing, a lot of the things that it was saying. And then Bo is Afraid kind of missed me again, although there were parts of Bo is Afraid that I really liked. And then this one just nailed me. I think it's possibly his most accessible movie, if that makes sense. And because of that, maybe there's a way in. But he's not pulling punches with kind of the commentary, the violence, those kind of things. Just to give you a little background on what we're doing here, Joaquin Phoenix plays a small town sheriff. Pedro Pascal plays the same small town mayor. They are kind of the figures in this pandemic set battle between polar sides, right? Which is something we've all experienced throughout time, not just during the pandemic, but that seemed to heighten a lot of things about the polarization of our country, those kind of things. Emma Stone is Joaquin's wife. Austin Butler steps in with a really interesting performance. So there's a good cast here. And most importantly for me, I walked away from this movie chewing on so much. I think he has a way in this movie of, and this will be a bad word to some people, I apologize. He has a way of being centrist in this movie that I find really fascinating, because there's an element of empathy for all of the characters, no matter what quote-unquote side they fall on. And there's a way that it shows how radicalization impacts our lives, not through the grander scale that we usually think of it, but because of the personal, intimate things that are going on in our lives, how they impact the way we are radicalized, the way we believe, those kind of things. Beyond that, it's a really fascinating, I would say comedy of errors, but more tragedy of errors as the movie just kind of descends into this small town hell. And I have a lot to say about this, but so much of it needs spoiling to say it probably. I'm still thinking about this movie, reeling from it.
Explain my side remark earlier. I haven't seen this movie. I don't know anything about it. I've just read headlines, and the headlines are exhausting me because this movie is apparently very divisive. You either hate it or love it, it seems. And I'm seeing so many headlines that actually, Eddington is the best movie ever. And then the next headline I read would be like, Eddington sucks. What are you talking about? And the next headline I read would be like, half of Eddington was great and half of it was terrible. And I'm just, you know, I haven't read any of these reviews. I've just, you know, I consume a lot of media and a lot of it is just looking at a headline going, do I want to read that? No. but it just seems like it's a really polarizing movie. So I'll be really curious when I finally see it, how I land on it. You know, I like all the actors. I'm like you when it comes to Ari Aster. I'm basically, he's been hit or miss for me. I think I'm more miss. I liked Midsommar, believe it or not. It's a very interesting movie for him to make, after what I've seen him make prior to this. So I'm curious.
I wasn't a fan of it. I'm in the camp of there are a lot of good things and there are a lot of bad things about it. I don't think this movie is focused enough on to fully recommend it. I feel like it starts off a certain way that I'm like, okay, I can get along with this a little bit, although it is a little bit tiring relitigating COVID again. That's what this movie does a lot of times. I had some funny observations, you know, how people who would wear masks would wear the mask underneath the nose and stuff like that, and like, you know, like, what are we doing here. But then there's a direction this movie takes that I'm like, yeah, what are we doing here? Because it just, I was like, does this movie have to be 2.5 hours? Does it have to go in like 2 or 3 different directions? I wasn't following it. Again, this could be a movie that I watch later on down the line and I'm like, oh, I love everything about what this movie did. But right now, having freshly watched it, I'm not a seconder on this one. I think there's a lot to be warned about before you go in to watch it. So
I think that's fair. I think that's absolutely fair. And I understand some of the hate this movie is getting, and a lot of it falls under the category, not for everybody, but for some, of too soon. Like, we just went through this. Like, I'm not ready to, you know, think about this right now. And I get that. I heard somebody describe the movie as a mirror. And, you know, the idea that because it focuses on the ridiculousness of humanity, both, you know, conservative, liberal, right, left, whatever, that sometimes it's hard to see ourselves in movies. And I think there's a little bit of truth there. But what I hear you saying is that the movie didn't have a consistency for you. It tried to do too much and kind of went all over the place, which is not how I felt while watching it, but I totally understand.
Yeah, I kind of felt like in the other directions it sort of took, it could have been a little bit. It's hard to say without spoiling it. So anyway, I'll leave it at that.
How does Emma Stone find the time to make a movie with this guy? In between all the Lanthimos movies,
because she's barely in this one.
Oh, is she not in it? Very
she's
much?
Not. She's not in it a lot. So it's
neither is. Well, I won't.
All right. Fair enough.
Jeremy, what do you got?
I got Frost Nixon. With Frank Langella and Michael Sheen. This is a movie I caught a few days ago. It's basically my third time seeing it. And it's just really solid. Hey, that Ron Howard might be a good filmmaker. This is about a real set of interviews that David Frost, a journalist from the UK, conducted with Richard Nixon after Nixon had been disgraced and left office. These are real interviews. You can track down the footage and watch them. The movie is interested in both how the interviews come together, because Frost is not a journalist that one would say the world really respects right now. He's more of a goofy talk show host with pretty ladies on his arm. But he's passionate. I want to do this interview. The cast is stacked. Let me just give you the rundown here. Frank Langella, Michael Sheen, Sam Rockwell, Kevin Bacon, Matthew McFadden, Oliver Platt, Rebecca Hall, and Toby Jones. And basically, it's the negotiation between Frost's people and Nixon's people on how the interviews will take place. And then there's the drama regarding him trying to find a network to run this or sponsors to pay for this, which proves to be difficult. And it's one of those things that, you know, it's kind of a miracle these interviews ended up happening. But once they do happen, the focus becomes the gamesmanship between a really strong debater like Nixon and Frost, basically a babe in the journalistic woods, if you will. And Nixon just stomps on him for 3 days, just runs wild. And Frost really wants to nail Nixon, get him to admit something, get him to say sorry or what have you. It all comes down to the fourth day, which is the only day he's allowed to ask about Watergate and whether or not he will nail Nixon or if Nixon will continue to run all over him. This is based on a stage play. Even if you know how it happens in the real world, this is a pretty riveting watch to see it unfold. I just really, really liked it. So there you go. Frost / Nixon is the actual title.
One of the, like, I think 4 or 5 Ron Howard based on real life, actually I think it is 5 based on real life movies that are all excellent in some way. Mm. The interesting thing about this is exactly as you were describing. I believe that a lot of these Frost Nixon interviews, if you were to watch them uncut, throughout, there'd be a lot of boring shit in there, and you wouldn't even, you know that something big happened out of these interviews until you finally get to the one part where this movie focuses on, you know, where he finally got him to say something and whatever. But yeah, another, this is another one I can recommend. I haven't seen it since it came out, though. It was really good.
Yeah. I saw it a few times that year it came out. I really, really liked it. And, it's kind of one of those movies, and Ron Howard is really good at this, where it just feels like it builds really well and it feels good, and then the thing happens and you're like, yes, the thing happened, you know? And it's like, he's really good at doing that. I, for one, am always excited to see what he's up to. Eden, I think he has coming up, seems to be like it's going to be really cool. So, yeah, we'll keep an eye on Ronnie Boy, Little Opie.
Yeah. Keep an eye on him. He's an up and comer. We wish him the best. All right. On to my a small recommend, which is City Lights from 1931. Charlie Chaplin made this movie in an era where sound had become a thing. Like, people came to watch talkies at this point, but he came out with this movie from the other era, basically, in 1931, and he plays again his familiar tramp character, who in the beginning of the movie saves a rich person from throwing himself into the river, and they become friends. But the problem is that it seems like this wealthy man only recognizes Charlie Chaplin when he is drunk. So when there's a point where when he sobers up, he even wonders who the hell this guy is that's in his house, that's been, you know, that he's been invited in and everything. In the meantime, Chaplin also runs into a blind girl selling flowers and falls in love with her. He starts at some point, he sort of misrepresents who he is. After a while, she thinks he's a wealthy person because the wealthy guy has been giving him money and he's been using the money to help her out and everything. But then there's at one point where there's a sort of a point where the girl and her mother or grandmother are sent a note saying, you owe this amount of rent or you're going to be kicked out tomorrow or whatever. So Chaplin goes around looking for jobs to help her out. Now, of course, that's just the bare bones plot synopsis. If you know Chaplin movies, you know that each scenario has a whole bunch of things that he has set up to do comedy, basically. And so there's a lot of, like, you know, just really fun Chaplin set pieces and everything. I was reading some trivia on this. Apparently he was so controlling about how everything should look in this movie and how everything should be done that he would go up to the actors and, like, he would play their parts, and then he would go and play his own part and back to his own parts. And this is how you do this. Oh, and there was an interview with somebody from a survivor from that film, like from 2000s or whatever, who said, I think that if Chaplin had his way, he would have played everybody's part in this movie, because he's so dedicated to what it was supposed to look like. But yeah, this is considered, I think, his best, one of his best, at least. I know that he considers it his best, and there's a lot of, like, big time filmmakers who believe this is his all time best or whatever. So, I'm not sure about that myself. I've seen a good 15 to 20 Chaplin movies. I'm not sure if this is my favorite one, but it is certainly, it's got an ending that will get you for sure. The ending will get to you. And it's one of those things that it leaves you with that impression that you have watched one of the best movies ever, even though I think it's really good. I don't want to, like, downplay it or anything. It's just that it's, like, it's weird that this one's considered the best, and there's, like, others that I think he did more interesting stunt work and camera work and stuff like that. But anyway, good movie. Highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a really interesting story that you touched on about deciding to make another silent film when silent films were pretty much, you know, on the way out. Mm-hmm. And I think it works. He does use some sound effects, which is interesting, because so he does have some sound in there. But yeah, I really enjoy this one as well. And the ending is great. It also, it's also really interesting how it uses the flower girl's blindness as a part of many humor setups, many gags, you know, that kind of thing, without it ever feeling mean. Like, it never feels like, you know, there's punching down going, or that it's making, you know, light of her blindness or whatever. It just feels, and a part of that is because of the romantic relationship between them. It always feels like, you know, that it's honoring her. So it's really good.
Yeah,
I'm fascinated by the turn from silent to talking. I love in Babylon when Brad Pitt goes into the audience of his first talkie, and he's been a silent film star, and his voice is so ridiculous, the entire audience just starts laughing at him. And I'm just like, well, it's an entirely different kind of acting to do a silent film than to do... There's almost no one that could immediately cross over from one to the other. It's like acting on stage versus acting on television.
All right, on to our big recommend, which is Winter's Bone, and this was Aaron's pick. So Aaron, take it away.
Oh shit, I forgot to watch it.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Winter's Bone is a 2010 thriller directed by Deborah Granick, and known for introducing most of the world to Jennifer Lawrence. The movie was a huge hit critically and filmed in the Ozarks of Missouri, despite never once visiting Silver Dollar City or Lambert's, the home of Throat Rolls. The movie starts with a woman singing an a cappella tribute to Down Home Missouri as a couple of kids play on a rickety trampoline, try to skateboard on a dirt driveway, and a young woman does laundry outdoors. That woman is 17-year-old Ree Dolly, played by Jennifer Lawrence, and she's clearly raising her younger brother and sister in abject poverty in the hills of the Ozarks. We see her doing her mama's hair and walking the kids to school while doing some spelling lessons on the way. After some time prepping on, after some time peeping on a baby raising class in the ROTC at the school that she goes to, she has to get rid of her horse because she doesn't have the money for feeding hay to it anymore. And the movie didn't want its beating of the dead horse about poverty to become literal instead of figurative. Then it's back to the homestead to chop some wood, and you get the sense that Ree is doing everything she can just to survive. The police stopped by to talk to Ree's mom about Ree's daddy being out of jail, and welp, he might be cooking meth again. And worse than that, he signed over their property for bond and can't be found anywhere. If he doesn't show up, they'll lose the meager existence they currently have because his bond was tied to the property. She swears she'll find him, and the police head away. The neighbors bring over some venison and offer use of their wood splitter and check in about what the police were doing at the house. Ree then goes to a friend's house to see if she can borrow some wheels to get down to the Arkansas line to try to find her dad. But the husband of the friend says no, and then Ree chastises her friend for being such a trad. The next stop is to visit her dad's brother, Teardrop, who also doesn't seem to want to help, as indicated by the way he chokes her when she dares to ask twice. Little Arthur is mentioned, but we get the sense this isn't someone you want to get messed up with. But a gift and a doobie later for the road, she's headed that way. That trip doesn't really bring much, but she's then sent up the hill further to another dangerous Ozarkian, and the movie is turning into quite a redneck mafia scavenger hunt. I think the guy's name is Thump, and whoever is in charge of the Ozark nickname distribution needs checking in on. After some convincing, the woman standing guard for Thump goes to ask him, but she is turned away again, and Ree is told to go back home or else. Ree does head back home, but halfway through browning some taters, she's dragged out to go see the meth house that her dad supposedly died in, even though she says he was known for never messing up a cook. That was like his thing. He didn't mess up the cooks. When they get back, Ree tells the kindly neighbor that maybe if he wants to lie about her dad dying in a meth explosion, it should be at a house without so much foliage growth to prove him wrong. Ree does some rifle safety with her younger brother and sister, and then her friend from earlier shows up to prove she's no pushover, as she now has the keys to the truck that she managed to sneak away from her tracksuit hubby. The first stop finds us at a birthday party with a full Ozarkian jam session at the house of a former fling of her father, Jessup. The woman says she saw her dad, Jessup, a few months ago, and he was happy, but then she spotted him a few weeks ago, and she could tell by the dead look in his eyes that something absolutely terrible was going on. Back at home, it's time for a squirrel hunt, and Sandy and Rocky are shot, skinned, and stewed as the kids continue prepping for their roles in the upcoming sequel, Hundreds of Squirrels. But later, at the log splitter, brother Teardrop shows up again to see if she likes drugs yet and to encourage Ree to sell the woods while she can, as Jessup missed his court date this morning, and he ain't never coming back. Ree has a heart-to-heart with her unresponsive mother about it, but she remains zero help. Later, when the bondsman shows up, she finds out that she basically has a week left at the current homestead unless she can prove that her dad is dead.
You said a heart-to-heart with her unresponsive mother. That's, wouldn't that right. just be a heart?
Yes, exactly. That is exactly correct. Yes, exactly. Out of desperation now, Ree tracks down Thump at the local cattle auction and ends up beaten, hogtied, and kidnapped for her trouble. Bloodied and bruised, she finally gets her audience with Thump and lays out the situation before Brother Teardrop shows up to vouch for her and take her home to safety. Turns out that Jessup had turned rat, and that's why Thump had him killed. Teardrop asks her to keep him in the dark about anything she does because he knows that his life is on the line as well. Some black and white squirrel footage later, Ree has recovered enough to have discussions about finding places for her siblings and getting the lowdown on how a military signing bonus actually works. Brother Teardrop comes by and grabs Ree for an excursion to the local honky-tonk to try to get more answers. But instead of answers, Teardrop just ends up doing some windshield work with an axe that encourages the owner of the truck he smashed to quote some tombstone at him. Later that night, Teardrop and Ree are pulled over by the local sheriff, and in a tense standoff, we're let in on the fact that it was this sheriff who told Thump that Jessup turned rat and was the one who got him killed. When all seems lost, suddenly the sisterhood of Thump, Ex Machina, comes by to take Ree to where her dad is buried. Well, not actually buried, more like damply secured. It's time to put it behind them, they say, so they potato sack her head and take her out to a canoe in the middle of the night. After making her dig around for her daddy's arm, they chainsaw the hand off for proof. But apparently that's not enough because someone might cut their own hand off just to escape bond. And on one hand, that might seem a bit far, but on the other hand, many hands do make light work. Mm-hmm. Ree does her best Holly Dunn impersonation and delivers her daddy's hands to the law, and the house will now be theirs. As Brother Teardrop comes by with some baby chicks to raise, the bondsman returns with what's left of the paid bond for the family to use now that it's been proven Jessup is dead. Meanwhile, you're still trying to place that Holly Dunn reference I just made. Just trust me, it's a really good one. Finally, Teardrop plays some banjo on the front porch as Ree and her siblings listen on. Ree then offers him some of the bond money, but he says to hold on to it for him as little sister Ashley takes over the banjo playing. And I suppose that's about as happily ever after as you're going to get in the hills of the Ozarks. And that is Winter's Bone. What did you guys think watching it?
Go ahead, Chris.
Very well-deserved Oscar nominations for Jennifer Lawrence and John Hawkes in this movie. I think this was sort of a lot of people's first introduction to John Hawkes. He had a long career before this. I mean, he was in Deadwood and stuff like that, but like, I don't think very many people knew who he was before this movie came out, and he's really good. Now, Jennifer Lawrence is only 18 years old. I feel like she was already just super good I don't know. She probably did some stuff before this. I don't think I was aware of her before this, but she just, there's something advantageous about not having seen someone's like child filmography and then you see them as an adult, because it's always hard to get that out of your head that they're not kids anymore a lot of times. So it was kind of an interesting introduction to Jennifer Lawrence, because she's still a kid, but like she's barely an adult when she makes this, but she's already like just super good. It's no wonder that she's shot up so quickly after this movie. She was like in just everything and just everything big, and everybody wanted her in movies after this. But, the story is unique. This is the thing that, you don't see very often, where there is a murder, but who done it is not important. And then the reasons why someone is looking to find out where the murder victim is isn't so much, oh, I need closure or I need any of this. It's to survive. It's to find, it's to find these, to find proof that he's dead so that they don't owe this money and they don't have to give up the house and all of that. That is such a different take on this kind of thing that we've seen so many times. And that's one thing that's really stark about this. It's very simple, but it also has a very different narrative that I don't think I've seen in other movies before. I feel like overall there's the main thing I got out of this, if there was anything deep to talk about, is this is clearly a patriarchy that she's trying to solve a crime in, and people don't want her to know where her father is because they don't want, the law to come down on them and all of that. But you can tell that there's small victories that can be had here and there. If you have the right story, if you appeal to the right people, the very beginning, she's able to give her horse to the one neighbor, very reluctantly takes it, but that's one sort of kindness she gets at the beginning. Then there's her, sister, cousin or somebody, I can't remember who it is that she goes to. She wants to help, but her husband obviously doesn't want to help. It's getting that truck and all of that. And every time she goes to these houses, she's running into the women, and the women are all like, man, I'd love to help you, but if I do, there's an unfortunate consequence to them helping her at all, even though they feel in their heart like there's a good reason to help her out. She's not out to get us, even though that's what I think everybody probably rightfully believes, especially since her dad just tried to turn on them and everything. So, like, there's a wariness to her, even though her story is good, and that they could easily help her out if they wanted to. They just don't want the heat and everything. But you know, this is what this movie keeps building up to. She finally has appealed to the right people, and Dale Dickey, who's a great actress, she's been in a million different things, and I think she's from Tennessee. She has probably the best performance outside of the two leads in this one, and has one of the best characters as well. You know, she finally appealed to the right person, and someone who knew exactly the right way to give her what she wanted without screwing everybody else in the same, even though probably if she were to have been found out during this trip, she would have probably gotten killed too, or something bad would have happened to her as well. So she's able to do this in a way that, you know, she had plausible deniability about what happened, and she can help her out in the end. So I really like this. It's a very simple movie. Like I said, it's not, there's not much to it other than very different narrative and a very a subtle way of talking about the patriarchy. So really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah, it's great. I think this was my third time through. And I wouldn't go so far as to say no one else could play this role, but this is the kind of role that you had to cast Ree perfectly, because she she carries the whole movie. She's in basically every scene, and she is our window to everything. And she has to play toughness in the right moments. She has to play vulnerability in the right moments. It's a really demanding role, and it's, in my opinion, no wonder why she took off like a rocket after this, because I think the industry went, oh yeah, okay, that's somebody who's got range. I gotta tell you, at this point in my life, anytime Garrett Delahunt shows up in a movie, it's like a warm hug to me, man. Like, he's just, I just feel like, okay, I'm in a good place here. This is, he seems to be in generally good movies, and he's just a really welcoming, like, when he showed, I forgot he was in this movie, and when he showed up, I had a grin across my entire face just because I really like his presence. The movie does a great job of having a character loom large who never appears on screen, right? We build up the legend of, was it Jessup was his name?
Yeah.
Her dad. Everyone knows her dad. Everyone knows stories about her dad, and we only get to meet his severed hands. We don't ever get to meet the man, and yet he informs so much of the actions the people who do appear on screen take. And I think it's very tough to do that. I think a lesser movie would have tried too hard, maybe. I'm not sure. One thing stuck with me this time that had never stuck with me before, and I don't know if it's profound or just stuck with me, but when she is teaching them how to field dress the squirrels, if you will. She snaps at her younger brother and says, sometimes you're going to have to do things even though you're scared of them, or something like that. And he says, I'm not scared. I just don't want to. And that took me back to high school biology when we dissected frogs. I was afraid to do it. I just didn't want to because that shit is gross. I don't want to do that. And I feel like that could just be a throwaway line, something a child says. But I feel like it does kind of apply to Ree throughout a lot of this movie. There are certainly scenes, moments where she's scared. When dude comes to her house and basically forces her into the truck, I think she's scared. But when she's walking up to these houses and confronting these women, especially the first half of this movie, she's not scared. She just doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to have to go through this. But because her dad is an idiot and has disappeared after signing over their house, she's got no option. If she wants to care for these kids, if she wants to have a roof over her own head, this is the only path. Anyway, again, I'm not sure if I'm just reading too much into that. I actually wrote down, I only have one negative thing to say about this movie. I really, really love it. The only negative thing I have to say about this movie is Hollywood. When someone feels like their world is closing in on them, cutting to a shot of vultures does not add anything to the moment. If someone is about to face a serious grave situation, throwing a thunderstorm in there does not add to the situation for me. These are visuals that have been done to death. Now, maybe not in 2010, maybe not, no, surely in 2010. When they cut to that Vultures, I was groaning. Otherwise, this movie is perfect. I think everyone is really well cast. Like Chris said, it's very simple. It's right to the point. It doesn't waste a single scene. And, you know, Jennifer Lawrence could never give another great performance again, and this would be an all-timer performance.
And that's the thing, too, that a lot of the actors who were cast around the main ones were locals that they found, you know, they wanted to be really authentic with everything. I watched the commentary on this. Commentary's okay. It's basically like a lot of, this is what happened that day and this is what this person did and whatever. But nearly all the actors that you see, and especially if you go to the IMDb, a lot of these people don't have pictures or anything. That's just, you know, they were hired right there in Missouri or Arkansas or something like that. And they all do an amazing job. Now, I wonder how this would have played if Jennifer Lawrence was already a huge star at the time and everything, because it kind of works out in their favor that she's not when she comes. I can just imagine what that would have been like.
It is funny, though, that whole story we're talking about how she auditioned and they thought she was like too pretty, and then she walked in New York and got the part. That's wild to me because she's still beautiful in this movie. They made her ugly or anything. But her talent cuts through any concern with regard to her looks, I think.
Yeah. Well, and also she's from Kentucky, so I think that also sort of helped her out too. That was, you know, even though she's already kind of shed a Southern accent at this point. So anyway, there you go.
My friend Andrew, who I've podcasted with, actually auditioned to be in this movie. Mm. He was taking acting classes at the time, and he has good friends that are in the movie and that movie, you know what I mean? It's just like that happens sometimes. Having said that, I didn't recognize any of those woods. I don't know that I've been there. I think the school she went to is in Forsyth, which is just down the road. I didn't really recognize a lot. I actually want to go deeper on the things you said because you hit on the main things that I wanted to say. Chris, I think you were talking about how different this movie is in its construction of what the protagonist wants, right? Usually there's revenge involved, or, you know, like this is a John Wick story where she's, you know, or in the first time you watch this, you can be forgiven for thinking that this is going to be a father-daughter movie. This is going to be about, like, how fathers, you know, relate to their daughters, or, you know, the consequences of the father's actions on their children, those kind of things. And the father just isn't, you know, he's in a bog. He's not available. Everything in this movie kind of feels like it's about doing what has to be done, even though it's hard. And I think that squirrel scene you talk about is specifically there to bring home that kind of idea of we do what we have to survive. We do the perseverance of the necessary and take the next step, even though it's dangerous, even though it's hard, because the alternative is just ending, you know, and we don't want to end. So
I also, just as a footnote, I appreciate that when she gave them the option of boiling or frying the squirrel, both kids immediately said fried. That's kids after my own heart right there.
The correct answer. And I think the movie is doing something with the squirrel metaphor. I think she is the squirrel in many ways. I think that's why she has the squirrel dream sequence, like this idea that, you know, this little animal survives in the forest despite having all these predators and all these things. And, you know, there's so much focus on squirrels in this that I do think there's an intent there to kind of do a little metaphor that's maybe a little more subtle than Vultures and Thunderstorms. I don't know. But there's that too. I really enjoy this movie. Enjoy's a weird word. I'm really into it. Every time I watch it, I'm just really into it. A lot of that has to do with the performances. And there's just something about, you know, how is she going to accomplish this impossible thing and keep her family safe. And, you know, it's not fair. It's not okay. It's, you know, poverty is ugly and gross, and in a nation this wealthy, certainly shouldn't be a thing like this. And it's just an interesting look at how you persevere through that. So
Yeah.
I like that the little bit of IMDb trivia, the guy that played the army recruiter is a real army recruiter. Was giving answers that he would really give if those were the real questions. And that scene's fascinating to me because it kind of flies in the face of what I've been taught to think about army recruiters, maybe by movies, I don't know, or my own supposition. Because he's almost turning her away at every chance he gets. He's like, he's trying to make sure, like, this is actually the right move for her and something that she wants. And anyway, I just thought that was interesting. Probably another cast somebody who's here in the area, who's local, to fill this small role. But I thought that was neat.
Yeah, and the way that was acted out, I was almost certain that guy was a recruiter because there was nothing showy about it at all. It was just very, like, matter-of-fact and friendly and, you know, and it might also be different, Jeremy, from other movies that you've seen because maybe it's because she's a woman. I don't know. They don't, you know, if it's a dude, maybe that's a completely different interview scenario there. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I've always just assumed, I'm sure it's my assumption, I've always just assumed recruiters are hard asses like drill sergeants, but that can't be the way they go about it. It has to be the opposite. They have to be really nice and friendly. And then once you sign, then they give you over to the drill sergeant.
I once talked to a recruiter, not because I was actively looking to get into the service or anything like that, but this recruiter did, like, I think saw my size and all this other stuff and was like, yeah, you know, you'd be a good soldier or whatever. And he started talking to me and he says, what's your vision like? And I said, well, it's like whatever it was, like 23,000 or something. Like my vision's horrible, you know, even though I put contacts and everything in it. And he's like, oh, he's like, yeah, even corrected, we couldn't allow you into the army or whatever. So I was like, oh, okay, well, good talking to you anyway, you know. So yeah, exactly. So sad. All right, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's managed hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Shh, be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I'll go first this time, Jeremy.
Sweet.
The movie that I went over probably about 6 or 7 movies that I wanted to double feature this with some sort of Southern crime story or whatever. But what I ended up on is Women Talking. The idea of women living in a patriarchy and having to make decisions that they're in a really tough position there, where it's like, if we don't do anything, then the horrible things that are happening to us are going to continue to happen. If we decide to leave this place, even worse things could happen to us if we decide to do that. And it's no wonder why this is a big, huge conversation, and why it's so divided all the way through and everything. But that's what I kept coming up with on this one. I had several other ones lined up, but that one's the one that I couldn't shake. So that's the one I'll go with.
Really like it.
It's fascinating, not to go back to Winter's Bone, but that when Teardrop shows up to pick up her after she's been beat up, if the men had hit her, there would have been a problem. But the women are like, nope, it was me. Me and my sisters did that, and everybody's okay with it at that point. Like, it's such a weird system of rules. I don't have anything near that heady, and I'm disappointed. I'm going to give you a movie, but My absolute perfect double feature would be a season of television. I think, Aaron, you opened the bag on this last week. Justified Season 2, which is set in the poor, hilly countryside of Kentucky, and has a girl, it's Caitlin Dever, whose dad has disappeared, and people close to her are ultimately responsible for it. And I just think the tone of that season, that's all I could think about watching Winter's Bone. But that's a lot of commitment. That's like an 11-hour, 12-hour double feature. So to give you a movie so you can only spend 4 hours, I went with Room, mostly because it's a woman with very few options who will do whatever it takes to safeguard the child in her keeping. The circumstances are different for sure. The setting is different. But I think those two female characters have a lot in common. So I think that would be a good double feature.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was considering like double featuring this with Ozark because there were so many things parallels to that. I thought of Mud, the Matthew McConaughey, Ty Sheridan movie. Killer Joe, another Matthew McConaughey movie. Lone Star, another Matthew McConaughey movie. Yeah, exactly. But there were a lot of these like Southern flavored type movies that I was thinking of to team with this, and that's I like that a lot though. I like the Justified one even. I haven't seen that full second season of Justified. I started that series a long time ago, watched the first season and got through a little bit of the second and have been stopped and then have not continued. But Room's a really good one. Room's a really
nobody wants
good.
To nobody wants to do Hillbilly Elegy. Nobody no votes for Hillbilly Elegy. All right, okay.
A, have not seen the movie, and B, no. All right, so next week's homework, it falls to me this time, and I am going to go back to 2008 with the movie Valkyrie. Sorry to a lot of you out there who know of Bryan Singer's piece of shittedness. Sorry about that, but I'm gonna go with this one. This is a movie that I feel like didn't get the attention it deserved. It got released Christmas Day 2008 along with a slew of other movies like Marley and Me and things like that. I don't think people were like they had a lot of choices in 2008 to watch certain things, and Valkyrie ended up being a decent sized hit, but for Tom Cruise it was kind of a middling type of thing. But I think this movie is intense and very well made, and I want to revisit it. I think it's a fantastic movie. You guys have seen this?
I've seen it once, and I remember it was on your recommendation, and I felt similarly that it was good and tense. But I don't really remember much. I'm excited to get back to it. It looks like it's on a lot of free services for streaming.
Yes, absolutely.
I haven't seen it recently, but I have seen it.
Oh, okay, good. Well, we'll be glad to talk this one over. So, I don't think I've seen it since it came out. I'm looking forward to that. All right, looks like we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
What's your favorite movie dog that doesn't die?
Woo!
That's a... So... You know, sorry where the red fern grows. You can't do that one.
Sorry, Marley and Me.
Yeah, sorry, Marley and Me.
Okay, just as an aside, before we get into this, we watch dogs through an online service, and it is incredible to me how many owners name their dogs Marley. We have watched 3 or 4 different Marleys, and I'm like, did you see the movie? What are you setting yourself up for? Sorry, that's just an aside.
Yeah. Well, that's why I name my pets things like Temporary.
Temporary?
Yes, exactly. On my list, I have the dogs that Halle Berry owned in John Wick 3. They are the best. That movie continues to, like, it's one of those John Wick 3 is one of those experiences that just always seems to give back. Every once in a while, you'll just think about the movie and all the different things that happen in it, and it's like, holy crap, and you're like, that scene and that scene, and oh my God, Halle Berry's dogs are so awesome in that movie, and like, just like every time one of them is in trouble, it seems like a sudden dog comes into the picture and starts eating somebody's leg or something. It's great. So those are my favorite.
Well, that's clearly the best answer. So I had to go with Brad Pitt's dog in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, it's a good one.
He has a good payoff in that final scene. And that's a good boy. That's a good dog.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good boy. Mm-hmm. I went with Bolt from the movie Bolt.
Yes.
I really love that movie, and I think a lot of it has to do with the humor that comes from this dog that literally thinks it has superpowers because it's in a TV show. Or movies or whatever it is. It's a lot of fun, and it's well voiced by Travolta. So, yeah.
Yep, that was a Miley movie back in the day. Miley was.
She was the cat.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
Was she the cat? I thought she was the main girl that was.
Oh, she was Penny.
Yeah.
She was the owner. Yeah.
All right, looking over at the chat, Slab says, I will not stand for this Beverly Hills Chihuahua erasure. I don't know where the erasure is coming from. Maybe it's somewhere up higher in the chat that I didn't see. But Alan says, Einstein from Back to the Future. Now, yeah, that is a good boy for good sure. Boy. No doubt about it. Lang says, Chance from Homeward Bound. Mm. Josh says, The Thing, maybe. Yeah. Hard to know whether the dog actually survived or he's just an alien creature with the DNA of millions of other alien species inside of him. I don't know.
I don't think it's hard to know if that dog survived.
Yeah, that dog. Exactly. Yeah, definitely. Tatsu says, Milo from The Mask. Yeah, another great dog for sure.
Yeah.
Looks like we have time for one more. Top five sports movies of all time. Now fight.
Fuck.
It says. I have these listed. The Natural is my favorite of all time. I've watched The Natural probably 100 times because I picked it up as a kid and I used to watch it constantly when I got it on VHS. Hoosiers is on that list. Bull Durham, Tin Cup, and Rocky are all on my top five list. So
what's fascinating is the ones that we all put on our list. So mine is Moneyball, Tin Cup, Miracle, Rocky, and Hoosiers.
Just a couple of differences there.
Mine is Moneyball, Hoosiers, Rocky, Field of Dreams, which nobody mentioned, and Miracle.
I put Field of Dreams on there for sure. It's just I felt like you were going to be the guy that doesn't call it a sports movie.
It could certainly be argued that it is not a sports movie. I think we've actually talked about this before, but yeah.
I struggled to possibly add Major League to this because I'm a big Major League fan, but I just couldn't fit it in the five. Like, I can't put it over any of those other ones, but I love Major League as well. Looking over at the chat, Slab also mentions Miracle and Rocky. Josh Zero says The Natural is a terrible movie and a terrible book. You are wrong, Chris. I have read over the book and I didn't read the whole book. The book is terrible. Correct. The movie is not terrible, and I will fight you on this. I had actually had a semi fight in an interview with a director who made some movie where the two characters argue about The Natural or talk about how shitty The Natural is or how silly it is or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I brought it up.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I said, I have a bone to pick with you about The Natural, you know, and like, you can't say this movie is that silly. The movie is very silly. Okay. It's sure. very silly, but I love it as a lover of baseball. It's exactly how you feel, when these epic moments of things happen in baseball is it's even more than what you can describe. And that's the what I love about
the
Natural.
I told you this, but this was, I was in love with The Natural in middle schoolish, and my next door neighbor, my best friend, we both loved this movie. And this was when DC Talk was kind of getting popular, right? We wrote a rap song about The Natural, and the chorus had the score from the big home run.
Right.
And that was the music underneath our rap song. That song is gone forever, I'm sorry to say. It did not was not committed to memory or paper, but we did write that song. That's how obsessed we were with that movie.
Continuing over on the chat, Slab says A League of Their Own. Yeah, that's a good one. I do like that one quite a bit. Josh, again, just being an irritant all day today, Field of Dreams is also not a sports movie. Slab says Karate Kid. Yeah, Karate Kid's good. Okay. Tatsu says The Waterboy, The Longest Yard, Happy Gilmore, Happy Gilmore 2, Remember the Titans. I was like, that's 80%. It's 80% Adam Sandler. And Remember the Titans is all right. I like that. You know, Denzel, you can't go wrong with that. Casper says,
I'm sorry. Yep. I was just reading about Denzel and Remember the Titans last week. And in real life, that football team absolutely dominated. They beat everyone they played. They were like undefeated. Like the movie makes it all like, oh, they turned it around with the coach. But no, that team was dominant.
Yeah. That's your Disney for you. I mean, you know, Hoosiers was kind of like that too. Like it was like Hoosiers was not what we saw in the movie either. Castroff says Creed 3, Creed 2, Creed, Karate Kid, and Cars. Cars. Okay. Cars. Yeah, I get it. I'll give it to you. It's racing. Is it running? Is Cars running?
It's still racing.
I think you're right.
Let's see. Slab says Miracle, Rocky, League of Their Own, Karate Kid, and Bring It On. Ooh, a vote for Bring It On that one. And then Josh says, Any Given Sunday? I don't know, Josh. You've been so clear about everything else. Why don't you just say something?
Any Given Sunday is garbage, Josh.
Right, it's garbage.
The book
total
is
Al Pacino.
Garbage too.
Al Pacino's a football coach? No. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Next week is Valkyrie. Can't wait to look into that movie. And once again, chat, we appreciate you coming out today. Thank you so much. Even Josh, we appreciate Josh for coming out this week. Thank you so much for coming out and bringing it as always. But that's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time. See ya. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
What about you, Jeremy? How you doing?
What about me?
Yeah, what about you? Exactly.
What about me?
Exactly. What about you?
I'm defensive today. What about me? I about 6 months ago, 8 months ago, I got all worried about microplastics. And so I might have told you this. I bought these six glass bottles, like 16-ounce glass bottles. And I keep three in the fridge with water at all times, and every week or so I wash them out and switch them out with the other bottles. And I'm like, yeah, I'm defeating you, microplastics. And then I read 2 weeks ago an article that said there are actually more microplastics in glass, things that come in glass containers, than there are in things that come in plastic containers.
How
is that possible?
Now I'm just, bring it on. Like, I kind of want to start a bottled water company called Microplastics and just start selling it to people who are ready to accept that.
Yeah.
We don't even know. Science doesn't even know if microplastics are bad. I'm just assuming they are. I've spent the better part of a year trying to avoid them in my daily water intake, and that's impossible. That's impossible.
Yeah.
Finally, my years and years of drinking tap water are paying off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm drinking tap water. You have to put it in a container of some kind, Aaron, unless you're walking to the
Not if
faucet.
You just drink it right out of your hand, baby.
Now, I have always been a faucet drinker when I brush my teeth. I don't need no cups.
Nah.
I just dip my head under there.
Yeah.
Suck.
Yep, exactly. That's right.
Out of context quote of the episode. Mm-hmm. How about that Scotty Scheffler, huh?
Mm. I know that he has to do it for another several years, but he is on Tiger's trajectory. He has won his fourth major at the exact number of weeks Tiger won his fourth major. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And hilariously, Phil Mickelson in March said, "Do you think Scotty wins again before the Ryder Cup?" I don't think so, because Phil Mickelson's a huge tool, and Scotty has won several times since then, and he's been top eight, I think, in the last 10 straight tournaments he's played. If Tiger didn't exist, I'd be saying stuff like, I've never seen anything like this.
Well, as long as he's not getting in DUIs and, like, cheating on his wife and all these other things that Tiger Woods did, he will beat Tiger Woods.
He probably will, because, I mean, this guy's a pretty solid Christian from what I can tell, and has repeatedly said that golf is not his number one priority in life, but his wife and kids are, I think they only have one right now. He's just a solid
guy. Was that the little guy trying to run up the hill to the green after he won?
Probably.
Did I see that? Yeah, I think the coverage was on. We were at a restaurant or something, and there was this little baby trying to run up the hill to the green him or something.
He's got like a kid under 2 years old.
Yeah.
Of course.
So, yeah, he's not going to do the cheat on my wife. He's not going to get his car attacked with golf club.
I was going to say, there's never been a Christian to cheat on their wife.
It's always fun seeing sort of the new generation of these I don't know if you would call them secondary or you know, aside from the four major sports in America, you have stuff like golf and tennis and things like that. Like, I had sort of gotten away from tennis, not on purpose. I was a big, huge Rafael Nadal, Federer and Djokovic fans, just fan of all three of them. They were just so good, and they were good on different surfaces. And it was always interesting to see one of the best facing one of the best on that surface and like seeing if they could hang with them and stuff, and just all three of them just dominating at any different at periods of time. And as they started falling off, I was just like, I started losing a little bit of interest. But now, man, like, there's this Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz, basically just a rivalry that just has sprung up over the last couple of years or whatever. Now I'm interested in seeing more tennis now, like seeing if they can just keep on being these top two stars and maybe somebody else can emerge and, whatever. It's really the French Open final was insane. That one was so good. That was like reminded me of some really good Federer Nadal matches.
When I was growing up, we always watched tennis. It was, of course, we didn't have cable, and there were only half as many sports that existed back then. So if it was on TV, it was a sport we watched. And tennis was one of those. So it was like McEnroe and Borg and Lendl.
Yeah,
and we watched all four of the majors. Every time. And yeah, I just sort of fell out of that once I got access to other channels and sports and stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I should get interested in tennis again.
I was a huge Boris Becker fan for a while back in the day.
Yeah. That's funny too. Also, when like, cause you're, I mean, it's not no surprise. You're coming up with the tennis players that I saw when I was young, cause we're all about the same age. Mm-hmm. But like sometimes you're like, oh yeah, Von Lendl, he probably won like 10 majors, and Boris Becker, he probably won like 10, you know, like all these majors. And then you go back and look and you're like, Von Lendl won 4 majors or something like that, you know?
So who's the greatest of them? Who's the Gretzky of tennis then? Is it Federer?
I think Djokovic has the most majors of anybody, and to have done it in an era when Federer and Nadal were both dominant is insane. I think all three of them are probably in the conversation.
For 24 majors.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah. And just when you thought that, oh, you know, Nadal was going to be the number one, like, all-time major guy, Djokovic would just come in and win, like, a couple out of nowhere, and then just, you know, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's something that I'd like to hear all-time tennis greats try to debate. Do you think that the greatest stars of the 80s and 90s could have hung with Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic in their primes? Because Pete Sampras was amazing at one point, and Agassi was amazing at one point, and like, I imagine they would have, like, maybe gotten one or two from them, but I don't know. It depends. Like,
is the answer Serena Williams, maybe? Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
I know there's that distinction, and the men have a little more speed and strength or whatever, but if I'm thinking GOAT tennis, I think she's one of the names that, like, you know.
She'd definitely be up there. Although by her own admission, she says if I faced off against any of the guys in the tour, like if I the 87th ranked or whatever, I wouldn't get a point off of them or something, which I think is a little bit too humble. Probably she probably would, she definitely would have to be in that conversation.
Yeah, she's got 23 Grand Slam women's Grand Slams.
Wow. So Djokovic has more than anyone then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild.
I'm just amazed watching a sport where I realized that if you just threw me out there, I would not score a point. Like there wouldn't even be an accidental.
Right.
Like I would just lose 6-0, 6-0, 6-0, and all the points too. It would never be like a 15 by my name.
I'd have fun with it though, man. I would grunt so much. I'd have fun losing. But
you don't think you can get like a lucky ace? You know, like just one that you just hit perfectly. And no, you're probably right.
No.
I did look it up. Lindell did win 8 majors, Becker won 6. So nothing close to the 20s, but
still, that's 8 is still a lot. Like you know, the Djokovic and Nadal and Federer just put it so far out of reach that it makes 8 seem silly or whatever.
You might even say 8 is enough.
Oh,
you might say that.